Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, Horror Movies That Broke the Rules. And this episode is dropping late, which breaks my own rule because I hate being late. So I appreciate everyone's patience, not only with that, but I'm dealing with an issue that's probably going to make my voice sound a little stranger than usual. So I beg your patience for that too. This episode's going to be a little off the usual format. I tried to do a poll on our pages on the subject of what was the greatest year for horror ever. And for whatever reason, maybe just the time of day I put it down, maybe the subject isn't that interesting, there just wasn't enough of a response for me to build a whole podcast episode out of it. Not to leave you hanging, the winners, such as they were, since there weren't that many votes, were basically somewhere in the block between 1978 and 1981. I didn't expect so many votes to land in that period. I thought there would be more 80s. I mean, there were some other years in the 80s, particularly 87. But the voting seemed to skew towards 78, 79, 80, and 81. But because that didn't work out as an episode idea, and I didn't have enough time, I wasn't feeling well enough to come up with another poll in time to build an episode around, I thought I would do a throwback to a kind of episode we used to do where I get suggestions all the time from the Horror Weekly pages about movies to watch. But what's really exciting me about October is now there's starting to be suggestions about Halloween watch lists. And this isn't going to be a Halloween watch list episode, but you'll see when I explain how I arrived at this idea of horror movies that break the rules. So the Criterion Channel dropped a new collection, streaming collection, called Pre-Code Horror. And Pre-Code Horror is basically movies from the early 30s before the Hays Code, which was a code of draconian censorship, really slammed the door on the first classic wave of horror that kind of started with the Universal Monster series. I know there was a lot of horror before that, like Nosferatu and Cabinet of Caligari, and it said, like, but there was a coherent wave of a certain kind of horror in America. German Expressionism is clearly not an American phenomenon. So these movies really were coming right before that code slammed down and made horror toothless for a while. It came back pretty hard, pretty fast. Now, in the excellent introduction to the Pre-Code Horror collection on Criterion, the scholar they had talk about it mentioned that this set of Pre-Code Horror films would make the ultimate Halloween party list. Now, that's a subjective term, obviously. I've had lots of horror marathons leading into lots of Halloween weekends or eves or weeks, whatever, or the whole month of October for that matter. And my taste always has changed. Like, I grew up with classical, so I watched a lot of that. But then I really wanted to do like a gory Halloween or a foreign Halloween or whatever you want to, whatever theme you want to call it. But I went down a deep evil rabbit hole with this Pre-Code Horror collection, watched some other movies that weren't even in it, but sort of fall in that definition. And she was right. This scholar was right. This is going to be a really fun block of movies to have on and sink into right before like a very atmospheric, hopefully foggy, hopefully a little chilly, nights before Halloween or even Halloween itself. Now, I'm kind of thinking this idea is going to be a two-parter. I won't do the second part next because I might have you all involved to help, you know, turn it into a poll or a vote like we usually do here. Because there are lots of horror movies that I love and respect that have broken kind of other rules. I know the rules idea is a little amorphous, but I mean, to each their own, right? I'm thinking of movies like Psycho from 1960, which kills the main protagonist halfway through the movie, or David Cronenberg's Videodrome, which does meta, but like with no fun elements in it. Meta usually has at least some kind of light form of tongue-in-cheek or comedy, but Videodrome is one of the grimmest movies ever made. And there's tons of other examples, but because there are so many great pre-code horror movies, I'm going to stick with that subject for this episode. And I know you might be thinking, wait, these movies are pre the code of rules, so not breaking the rules. The rules got broken later, but that's actually not how this went down. So the code was instituted earlier, late 20s, early 30s, before most of the movies that we're going to be talking about on this episode were made. They were trying to enforce these rules, and part of why the rules got really codified and really locked down is because of how far over the line some of these movies we're going to talk about went. I'm going to talk about Todd Browning's Freaks. And this is another element of what I think about when I think about whether a movie breaks the rules. A lot of times when a movie goes way over the line, the people who made the movie pay a price, whether it's the main actor or the director or the writer, etc. Much like the movie Peeping Tom, which sort of destroyed a great director's career, Powell, Freaks was really the end of Todd Browning's career. This is the guy who made Dracula, for God's sakes, and his career pretty much dead ends after Freaks because of the backlash. And there was a severe backlash to the radicalism of some of these 30s horror movies. It was so severe, you're not going to believe where some of the backlash came from. For example, Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock wrote an article in 1936 talking about how movies should stick to thrilling and that horror films were a different thing. He actually wrote the term horror film, meaning originally extreme aversion, has been loosely applied to films which, to supply the desired emotional jolt, exploit sadism, perversion, bestiality, and deformity. This is utterly wrong, being vicious and dangerous. It is permissible for a film to be horrific, but not horrible. And between the two, there is a dividing line, which is apparent to all thinking people. That's right. Early 30s horror was too controversial for Alfred Hitchcock, who clearly changed his mind later in his career. Now, I'm going to start with one of my absolute favorites, which I probably should not be doing because it's later in the pre-code cycle, but I'm not going to be able to help myself because I love this movie so much. The movie is called Mad Love. It's from 1935. Astoundingly, Wikipedia defines it as an American body horror film. That's right, a body horror film from 1935. It's directed by Carl Freund, stars Peter Lorre, and Colin Clive, the legendary guy who played Frankenstein, and then Francis Drake as Yvonne. This movie is an absolute whirlpool of horror magnificence and talent. It's kind of a synthesis of everything that 30s horror was doing. It's literally based on a story written by a Guy Ndoré. Now, Guy Ndoré is the author of Werewolf of Paris, which is considered to be the Dracula of werewolf novels. It's a movie that was so shocking to audiences of its time that it was buried and shelved for almost 50 years, but yet it influenced Citizen Kane. It also shared a cinematographer with Citizen Kane. It's starring the actor who gave the single greatest performance as a serial killer in cinema history, Peter Lorre. I'm talking about his performance in M, which is the top of the mountain. And one of the absolute craziest things about this movie is that it is absolutely the scream of its time. It's so meta, it's literally talking to the audience in the opening scenes. It has It opens with people attending a performance of this horror play, something that was very on the minds of censors when they got the script for this, saying, what is this horror play that you're putting in the middle of, in the beginning of your movie? Don't do this, don't do that, don't show this. And they were like, yeah, no, don't worry, it's just a play. It's not, it's just, it's on the stage inside the movie. The play is based on kind of the Grand Guignol, kind of the French extreme horror notion of the time. And what's happening with the audience inside the movie, the people going to attend this play, is couples are breaking up before they even get into the theater. When the date is like, sees what's happening, the sign and the promotion for the play, she's like, we can just stop seeing each other if this is the kind of man you are, if this is the kind of entertainment that you seek. And she like stalks off. The audience in the watching the play inside the movie, again, I know it's confusing, sorry, they're squirming in their seats, they're averting their eyes, which is the same thing this movie is going to try to do to you as the real audience. Once the worst things happen on stage, the actual torture of the characters, you see people in their chairs in the audience like applauding and their eyes getting big and they're like, yeah, go extreme, do it more. So, I mean, this is from 1935 and it's just as relevant as anything meta that was released in 2023. Amazing. Now, the plot of Mad Love, it's based on a story called The Hands of Orlok, which was also a movie by Conrad Veidt. This is kind of a remake or reversion of that. Amazing that even back then they were doing remakes. But the idea, the plot of this movie is Dr. Gogol, who is played by Peter Lorre. He's this incredibly skilled surgeon. He has become obsessed with this actress named Yvonne Orlok. She's the one starring in the torture play that starts at the beginning of the movie. Her husband is Colin Clive. Stephen Orlok is the character's name, and he's a famous pianist. So basically, Gogol becomes obsessed with the actress. Her husband's hands are destroyed in a train accident. No one can help him. No one can save him. They're all recommending amputation. Yvonne brings him to Dr. Gogol. She knows at this point that Dr. Gogol is kind of like a creepy stalker type, but she's so devoted and in love with her husband that she's willing to turn to this person that she hates or is afraid of, because he's the only surgeon in the world skilled enough to maybe do something for her husband, and asks him to do something about it. And Gogol manages to, repair Orlok's hands. But what he does is he takes the hands of a recently executed killer, a knife thrower of all things, a serial killer who kills by throwing knives. I think he does some stabbing too. It's hard to discern, but anyway, he's really good at throwing knives. He gets beheaded via guillotine, which we're going to talk about in a second. And Gogol has that fresh body brought, takes the hands off of it, puts the hands, transplants the hands onto the pianist's body, and then says that he repaired his hands. They're under bandages, so you can't see them. When they become unwrapped, Steven's looking at the hands going, these don't even look like mine. Gogol goes, yeah, your hands were badly crushed. There was no way they were going to look the same. They're definitely yours. And then Steven finds gradually through the movie that having a serial killer's hands is not a great idea. Now, Peter Lorre's performance in this movie is stupendous. Not a surprise, because he's an incredible actor. But this is really something else. The scene where, so Orlok, not Orlok, sorry, Peter Lorre's character, he is Dr. Gogol. He is actually at the execution of the knife-throwing serial killer. His name is Rollo. And the reason he's there, it turns out, is he just loves pain and death. He won't admit it, though. And it's odd that he has taken the job of healing people through very painful surgeries as a way of doing. He's shown throughout the movie, like, healing wounded kids and people who are in dire straits. They think he's the great, he's the savior. They think he's the greatest thing in the world. And he's really soft and kind with them. But you can tell by the fact that these little touches in the movie. He has a Venus flytrap in his amazing house or flat, wherever he lives. And he has a housekeeper who talks. She's the amazing, drunk, hilarious character. She talks to the flies that land in the Venus flytrap. And as they crawl up it, she says to the fly, "You'll be dead soon, dearie. Don't worry, you'll be dead." He loves dead things. So Gogol is a weird character, but he's just attending this execution just to see it. Like, he's not there to collect the body. That happens later in the movie. And I am telling you, if you get the chance to, even if you don't like old movies, even if you can't get through the entire old movie because they bore you or whatever, it's near the beginning, but the scene where Peter Lorre's at this guillotining, the expressions on his face, the just cold, clinical, calculating interest he's showing in the proceedings of what they do with this process are remarkable. Gave me a chill. This is a movie that's almost 100 years old, and I got goosebumps. By the way, the soon-to-be-beheaded serial killer Rollo is, even though he has almost no screen time, is just an amazing, like, Renfield type of bit character. The actor is incredible. He's, like, so cheerful and jolly about being executed. Or not, he's not excited about it, actually. He's just, like, you can just tell he's so fatalistic that he's like, whatever, I've killed a bunch of people, now you're going to kill me? You know, that's life. But I have watched a ton of horror in the last year. I mean, I watch a lot of it anyway, but I've watched even more of it due to this podcast. And I am telling you, I don't think anything has made me laugh louder than the moment I'm about to tell you about next. It's so exquisite. So Dr. Gogol is obsessed with Yvonne. He has attended her plays performance 47 days in a row. Everyone at the theater knows who he is because he's like a rag. And they have a promotional wax statue of her in the lobby. Well, when the play closes down because she's marrying her husband and she's giving up her acting career, which is stupid, but whatever. He's distraught. He's like, this is, I've obsessed with this woman. I got to see her every night, and now she's just going to go be married and be like, you know, not in the public anymore where I can see her. So he's standing in the lobby, and then he's going outside, and then he sees that they're taking the wax statue and just going to toss it. They're just going to melt it down. And he bribes them to deliver this statue, which is a perfect likeness of his obsession, Yvonne, to his house. Now, meanwhile, the train wreck that has crushed Yvonne's husband's hands has happened. She's in a panic. She can't get a hold of Dr. Gogol. So she takes it upon herself to have her husband transferred from the hospital he's at, where they're going to amputate his hands, because she's trying to save his hands, and sent straight to Dr. Gogol's house. And then we get this scene where you see Dr. Gogol's house, there's a front entrance and a back entrance. And at the front entrance, there's an ambulance with this poor demolished guy getting carried in with his wife by his side, you know, in an attempt to save his life. And at the back entrance is the delivery of the wax statue likeness of Yvonne. So Dr. Gogol's house is this intersection of obsession and kind of an evil, creepy side. And then the doing good, like, this is the place where people go when they don't have any hope. They need some kind of like medical recourse. And the vision of both things, the guy's body being carried in the front and her likeness being carried in the back at the exact same time, was amazing. So Mad Love is an absolute masterpiece, a truly forgotten work of art of horror. Unfortunately, it was one of the very few 1930s horror films that actually lost money for its studio, MGM. It lost about $40,000. Who knows what that is in 1930s dollars? That sounds like millions to me. The movie had performed pretty well in larger cities and did well in Europe, but it was a complete, like, people walking out, nonstop complaints, disaster in smaller cities and towns in America. The most common complaint from the audiences in rural America, too much horror, too shocking. Great. And MGM, the studio, and the censors that gave this movie a pass were so embarrassed that a film that that was getting called perverse and sick and disturbing ever got certified. So they buried it, and it vanished for like 50 years. It wasn't really rediscovered until the 70s. But I absolutely adore this movie, and it would make an excellent lead up to Halloween watch. Now, this next movie is here for rule-breaking and establishing, because a lot of people consider it to be the very first slasher film. This isn't one of my favorites out of the pre-code bunch. It's called 13 Women. It's starring Myrna Loy and Peg Entwistle. It is a very, very stylish and gorgeous movie, but I think the plot is a little thin, but it is so intriguing to see something so old that has the same kind of pattern as a Friday the 13th and definitely has really slasher roots somehow. If you watch it, you'll see what I mean. And there's this atmosphere of doom that lingers around the movie because of Peg Entwistle. This is her only on-screen performance. She unalived herself by leaping from the letter H on the Hollywood sign. Her ghost is kind of rumored to linger around that sign. And it's so sad to see someone so talented. She does a great job in the little bit that she's given to do in the movie, but definitely worth a watch. Now, there is a movie that I fell in love with that I hadn't seen because there's a hint of animal mistreatment in this movie because it's called Murders in the Zoo. It stars Lionel Atwill, and it's because of the way zoos were run at the time. There are a couple of moments where, I mean, I've had rescue animals. I'm an animal lover, so I kind of just fast forwarded past a couple moments, but oh my God, the rest of this movie is so good. And if you haven't watched old horror movies, then Lionel Atwill, the star of this movie, might be the single greatest villain in movies you haven't laid your eyes on. The synopsis of Murders in the Zoo, which is from 1933, is a monomaniacal zoologist is pathologically jealous of his beautiful but unfaithful wife, Evelyn, and he will not stop short of murder to keep her. And he uses animals as his tool of murder often, although with a couple twists that even I didn't see coming, as old as this movie is. This movie is spectacular. Imagine a movie that's almost 100 years old. And when I finished it, I just went back and watched it again a second time consecutively through. It's just that good. So one thing that horror filmmakers of the early 30s were discovered as a way to get around the rules, to break the rules, to get around the censorship, is if they added an element of comedy, a lot of times the censors took the movie as not as horrific because they were focused on the comedy. It was like a little misdirection. Look over here, not over there, while I do horrific things in the film. And there are truly horrible things in this movie, so bad that it was banned for many years, which is going to be a common theme with the movies that we talk about on this episode. But oh my God, the opening scene of this film. First of all, this is going to be the only villain you ever see ride away from the scene of a crime on top of an elephant. Second of all, Lionel Atwill discovers or thinks he knows that his wife is cheating on him with this guy, or this guy's interested in his wife. All he did was kiss her. So Atwill, whose name is Eric Gorman in the movie, is this. He's the rich, you know, entrepreneur who owns a lot of animals. He sews this poor guy's mouth shut. He's tied up in the middle of the jungle. He sews his mouth shut. And when this guy leaps up and the camera focuses on him, I'm worried about this guy. I'm worried they really did it to him. His acting was so pure. His terror was so palpable. And the image is still disturbing after all of this time. But the plot woven in here is that there's a publicity guy, a PR guy, who's working for the zoo that Lionel Atwill's character mainly interacts with. This guy's petrified of animals. He's like Mr. Beaning his way through the whole movie. He's the comedy thread that kind of made the censors feel like, what is this thing even? And it's so jarring to see the movie veer from like straight up slapstick comedy into really, really horrific stuff. People being devoured by tigers, being eaten up by alligators or crocodiles. For you Kill Bill fans out there, there's some Mamba action for sure. But Atwill is just so damn good in this movie. At lines that could come across as corny, he delivers them with such like silvery evil tones that it's just like a Hannibal Lecter effect. When he gets back from the jungle after the opening scene, his wife wonders where her side guy is. And he's like, Atwill tells her, oh, you think he just decided to go home? And she goes, what do you mean? Like, did you talk to him? What did he say? And Atwill's like, he didn't say anything. I mean, his mouth was so shut, so accurate. But he says it with such evil ease and kind of like very subtle enjoyment in his face. Just kind of an amazing performance. There's a scene where the PR guy has conceived of this stunt of having a very fancy, very high class dinner in the middle of the zoo with the cages of the animals all around and everyone all dressed up in tuxedos and fancy dresses and it having like, you know, 12 course meals and stuff in the midst of this environment. And the dread that the people have on their faces while they're trying to eat is, I mean, then they kind of settle down, but then there's things happen and it gets really bad. But it's such an interesting metaphor for kind of the whole idea of what is the impact of a horror movie? Like, how comfortable can you get? And there's the thrill of being so close to danger, but then the regret of being so close to danger. Another thing I really like here is Gorman's wife, Evelyn, played by Kathleen Burke, who does a fantastic job. She's a fighter. Like she's going to lose everyone that's close to her because her husband is like insanely jealous and she's going to lose them in awful ways. But when she loses someone else that she's hoping to get away from her husband. It's so weird. This movie's so old, but the closest thing it gave me the vibes to, especially the whole sequence with his wife, which is like a good third of the movie, reminded me very much of Elizabeth Moss's Invisible Man. I mean, this guy is gaslighting her in just the same way. I mean, Lionel Atwill is such a good actor, and he's so sly and charming and evil that you can't help but feel like she's in trouble and she's overmatched, but she figures out how to outsmart him in some pretty clever ways and figures out what he's up to. But there's this sequence where she loses this guy who's close to her and she's just devastated. She thought she was going to go. She was packing her bags. And now she just walks into like the morgue and sees there's not only this guy that she cared for, but like her chance for getaway just lying dead on the slab. And she just looks stunned and she knows no one else around her knows that her husband is the one who murdered. It looks like an animal accident, obviously, but she knows. And it was so interesting watching it because I was trying to calculate. She's kind of like walking around in a daze, like an angry daze, but not saying anything. And I was like, does she know? And her husband takes her back home and is like, let me calm. You know, this has been an upsetting day. I'm sure you were worried about me, which she wasn't during the animal outbreak. The officer, a cup of brandy. And the first word she says, I mean, she's silent for minutes in a row. And then the very first thing she says is, you killed him. Just straight, direct, strong, and then he tries to pretend he didn't, and like they get into a fight, and she confesses that she loved him, and she loved this guy, and she was gonna leave Gorman, her husband, for this guy, and she goes, he's struggling with her, and she's like, let me go, and he just opens his arms, opens his hands, and lets her go, because he's not really letting her go, and he starts gaslighting her some more, and amazingly, Atwell starts to reveal that he actually enjoys this. He enjoys people getting close to his wife. He enjoys killing them. It makes him want her more. And the sinister glee on his face in this scene is remarkable. But she outmaneuvers him and almost gets away with it. And I don't want to spoil, like, you know, how this all goes down. But I liked that she was as tough, as smart as she was. So Murders in the Zoo is really brutal in parts. This is not a movie that could be made today. It's gorgeously shot, and the ending is very satisfying. Okay, next is a movie that I couldn't love more if I tried. It's from 1933, and it's called Mystery of the Wax Museum. This was a movie that disappeared for a lot of time and got rediscovered. There's so many unique and cool things about this movie. It stars Faye Ray and of King Kong and Screaming fame. It stars Lionel Atwill, who we just talked about. And it's directed by Michael Curtiz. That's right. I'm recommending and the lead up to Halloween that you put a movie into your Halloween watching marathon that's directed by the guy who directed Casablanca. Now, Mystery of the Wax Museum is basically House of Wax. And a lot of people didn't even know this existed because, again, a lot of these movies were very controversial and got shelved by their studios after their immediate release. One amazing thing about this is both this and Dr. X, same director, same stars, were the very last films filmed in two-strip or two-color Technicolor, which is all reds and greens, and it's so spooky and beautiful to watch now. This movie is so gorgeous. I could watch it with no sound. Now, the wax corpses in this movie are just as sinister as any other well-done kind of wax death movie. But because of the unique color of this, when the characters are trapped in the wax museum with these dead bodies covered in wax, it really made me realize it was really sinister. I mean, it's an old movie, but still kind of scary in that way. And I realized that wax characters like this, or wax, you know, figures like this, are basically non-moving zombies. Not in the they're going to bite you kind of way, but in the uncanny, eerie vibe that something is not what it should be. The creator of these figures in this movie refers to them as his children. He talks to them all the time. He when someone comes in and gives a compliment to the wax museum, he goes, "We all thank you," because he thinks of himself as part of them. We also have this incredible other plot going on of an investigative journalist named Florence Dempsey. What a great performance. I mean, there's nothing that Clarice Starling, that Jodie Foster's character in Silence of the Lambs, has on this character. She's just as capable. She's just as determined. She's just as smart. She basically blows through all the rules and conventions of polite society in this movie like a friggin' whirlwind. She's trying to figure out why all these bodies are disappearing from the morgue, not knowing that they're being fed into the creative maw of the wax museum displays. And as she discovers that, she's obviously scared, but she's also going to just push through it. And meanwhile, the figure that's stealing the bodies is this monstrous looking, like almost mutated Phantom of the Opera type figure. And then the scenes where characters are going to get the hot wax poured all over them alive are just as creepy then as they would be in any of the other iterations of this concept. Just an amazing film, but because of how it, the color of it, because of how it was created, What a rare treat. I mean, it's just so spooky. Like, I can, this is the, in my, like, if I'm watching the night before Halloween, this is my midnight one. This is my midnight movie. 'Cause I, at like 1:30, and this is another benefit of doing this kind of marathon with these movies, is they're all short, right? 'Cause they're all old. But this is the one I want around 1 or 2 a.m. on. I want to be a little bit out of it and just these beautiful colors from the film washing over me. And then let's not forget the great Fay Wray, who, I mean, what could be better on like a foggy, either Halloween or night before Halloween night, to have your neighbors hearing Fay Wray's screams coming out your windows, going out into the air. No one can do it like her. Now, Dr. X is the companion to this one, and I didn't like Dr. X as much as I liked Mystery of the Wax Museum, but the final sequence of it is, although kind of ridiculously staged, I mean, on behalf of the characters, this is one of those times where you're like, you can't believe the characters. I mean, they handcuff themselves to chairs with a killer on the loose. What could go wrong with that setup? But the actual killer himself, who is like somehow creating himself with something he calls synthetic flesh, is like, this is David Cronenberg in the 30s. Like, if David Cronenberg had been alive in the 30s, the last 15 minutes of Dr. X are a movie he would have made. Now, next we have 1934's The Black Cat, directed by Edgar G. Ulmer and starring Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. It was Universal Pictures' biggest box office hit of 1934. And even though it was censored all to hell because the skinning people alive scenes, go figure, were a little much for the censors at the time, among other things, considering the entire plot is about Satanism and the character, Boris Karloff's character, who's the head Satanist, is made somehow sympathetic, which, I mean, how are you getting away with that in 1934? But this movie has some really deep things to say about death, about war, things I couldn't do justice to without devoting like a third of the episode or more full episode to it. So I'll leave those to your enjoyment as you watch or perhaps research the movie if you get obsessed with it like I did, because it's a masterpiece. It's just an unbelievably weird, unique looking movie. But to see Karloff and Lugosi at the heights of their horror powers just going at each other as true rivals in this film is, I mean, as a horror fan, what else could you ask for? It's one of the very first movies to have an almost continuous music score. And that, along with the visuals, along with the incredible performances, and the fact that the movie's not pulling punches, like it goes to some really dark places. There's really dark places. I don't want to spoil the plot necessarily if you haven't seen it, but there's a reveal here that's still jaw-dropping to this day. At least it was definitely jaw-dropping to Bela Lugosi's character. But it's just like immersing yourself in a black and white nightmare, a gorgeously shot black and white nightmare. Okay, and just two more left for the pre-code Halloween party marathon watch, whatever I want to call this thing. We have Earl C. Kenton's Island of Lost Souls from 1932, starring Charles, the great Charles Laughton. The only movie he ever directed is one of the greatest horror movies ever made, which is Night of the Hunter, but he was also one of the greatest actors of his time. And this is based on H.G. Wells' story Island of Dr. Moreau. And I mean, this, so there's a lot about this movie. First of all, this movie was a trivia question on the Horror Weekly pages for a while, which was what movie influenced more rock and roll bands through the early era of rock and roll up until, like, say, the 2000s? And the answer is this one, the Are We Not Men, the whole Devo, the whole, like, Misfits. So many bands were inspired or impacted by the chants that go on, the crazy vibe of this movie, but also just the monster makeup inspired generations of special effects artists and movie artists, because the man beasts that Dr. Murrow is creating and the way they're shot are still so effective to this day. Island of Lost Souls is just excellence in pretty much every category, and also broke a lot of rules that the censors were very upset about, especially the whole notion of Charles Laughton deciding that he, if I can make life, if I can just bring life into being, I'm God. Like, what's the difference between God and me? And that was a step way too far for not just censors, but some audience at the time. And like the Old Testament God or some of the bloodier mythological versions, this is a God that has no problem inflicting pain. And Bela Lugosi, who plays such a great villain in so many roles, he gets to flip it here and be kind of in the victim side, but still with a sinister edge to it. And the way his voice just booms out in this movie, his charisma is just like volcanic. But now we get to my truest love of all, which is my final movie for the Halloween party, and that is Freaks, directed by Todd Browning, 1932. This movie broke just all the rules, just any rule you could name, it broke it. There were rumors that audiences members were passing out and having heart attacks, that audience people who actually sued the studio for exposing them to something so extreme, even though the studio cut, I think, 15 minutes of what they thought was the worst stuff out of this movie. Still, it was so potent on its release and so upsetting to people that it was banned outright in England. I think there are still technically laws, it's still illegal in parts of America to show this movie, believe it or not. The legendary chant from this film, the one of us, gooble gobble chant, has made its way into culture in a lot of ways. My favorite use of it in another movie was it being done by Lyle Lovett and Whoopi Goldberg, of all people, in Robert Altman's masterpiece, The Player. But the true rule that was broken by Freaks, that was probably a step too far. Everyone's going to say, oh, it's because he was using real circus performers in the movie with real quote unquote deformities. And, you know, that was that. And there's a lot of, you know, argument about whether it's exploitative or not. I mean, Todd Browning was in the circus. He was a circus performer before he became a director. Like, he loved these people and this culture. So, I doubt that anything was intended to be exploitative, but I mean, it is the 30s, right? So like, there's some real nearsighted ways of looking at things, but it's not that. The truest, deepest rule broken by Freaks is that it was the quote unquote normal people that were the actual villains. The villains are us. The characters Cleopatra and Hercules are profoundly selfish people with absolutely no moral code at all and completely out for themselves. And they're manipulating people for their money, or they're manipulating people for whatever they can get out of them, you know, drinks, food, jewelry. And the movie talks about the code of the Freaks. But the crazy thing is, it's a code anyone would recognize and probably want to live up to, which is basically we just look out for each other. We're non-judgmental for each other. We have each other's back. Like the movie says it in scare tones, like the code of the Freaks, but at least they have a code. The normal people, they don't have a code at all. They turn on each other. They have no kind of law or guardrails for that guides their behavior at all, except for moment to moment. What's going to feel good for me? What do I think I can get out of a situation? And the crazy and amazing thing amongst many treasures about this movie is that the characters that aren't Cleopatra and Hercules are saying really wise, really interesting, touching stuff to each other all the time in a lot of ways. And sometimes it's not all just verbal. It's kind of just the way they communicate to each other or the actions they take that are sending messages to each other. The way they watch for each other, like they're looking out and they're interested in what's happening to their fellow circus performers. But the bad characters don't want to be watched. They're operating in secret. They're hiding. And it's that kind of flipped around. I mean, it's almost heartbreaking to me that the whole idea of being in a circus, being exploited in a circus this way, is that people pay to lay their eyes on you. And you would think that if people were paying to lay their eyes on you, that kind of watchful thing would be something that would be very hard for you to take. But they effortlessly go with it for themselves. They're always watching out for each other. They haven't become blinded by how bad the world is. Meanwhile, the people who don't get it are in the shadows working behind the scenes to like screw everybody over. And the famous "Wheel Acceptor, One of Us" chant scene where they're passing around the loving cup is the thing is, it's completely misunderstood by Cleopatra. She stands up and yells that famous shout, the dirty, slimy freaks, and then is revolted at the idea of becoming one of them, which is ultimately her fate, spoiler. But it wasn't about becoming anything. It's about being integrated into a community, into a group, in whatever way you want. Like if you want to be part of it, we're giving the accepting. All you have to do is not fuck us. But she misunderstands what's on offer, as does Hercules. And that's the secret triumph and sort of tragedy of this movie, is that it's less about what you would think it would be, a movie like this would be about, and more about misunderstanding, just sheer stupidity. They don't know the value of what's being truly offered them. They place their values in the wrong places. And this is why, at the end, when Cleopatra gets the revenge wrought upon her and becomes a human duck or chicken or whatever she is, and she's just spouting gibberish at the end, it's not a change. She's been spouting gibberish the entire movie. That's the kind of morbid joke at the end of this film, is that she's making as much sense after she's been revenged upon than she was making before. Everything she said the entire movie was wrong. It was all nonsense. It was all a complete misjudgment of what actually was going on. And she was also just lying to everyone herself. So it's even worse than just saying nonsense. It was saying things that are actively false. Arguably, her gibberish mode might be even a better form of communication, because it subtracts less meaning by being, she can't lie anymore. And it's the characters Venus and Froso the Clown who also show that they understand what's on offer, which means it's a two-way street always. You have to give back a little. They watch what's happening, and they help make sure that bad things don't happen. They communicate and warn, which is very touching, but they know, like, we have to give back. And that's the limitation of the bad characters in this movie, is they're only about taking and not about giving back. And that, to me, is what the true heart of the movie is. It is a real shame that Todd Browning's career ended because of this movie, in large part. But because this movie exists and he made such a masterpiece, it's going to play on my screen heading into Halloween in tribute to what he was able to accomplish with his mind and his heart in creating something so great. So those are the horror movies that broke the rules, edition one, I suppose. If, like I did, you get a taste for pre-code horror, good news, there are so many other great movies from that time period. Some obscure ones, like Svengali and others that I hadn't seen, that you can expand, make you swap into your own list, perhaps. They're super fun to have on, even in the background, even if you're not watching. Just they have these lines that you know, that are everything we watch now is built on kind of the thrills that from that first wave of horror that really, really connected with audiences. And they have all these magnificent lines in them. And whether it's The Most Dangerous Game or, you know, a whole bunch of other pre-code horror movies, you've got people saying things like, "I promise you a night of horrific entertainment." And because there was like comedy inserted in some of them to get around the censors, the masterpiece of the absolute masterpiece of this is Bride of Frankenstein, where James Whale was playing chess against the censors and they just had no idea what a genius they were up against. I mean, he didn't get everything he wanted through, but he got everything he wanted through in a way, in the spirit of that movie. But it has really, really funny moments as well. So there's an energy, a jolt of energy to these movies that is just one of a kind. All right, so that's it. I mean, I have great news from the rating standpoint. Thank you so much. I see you all trying to push the podcast up to a 4.8 rating again on the Apple platform. I want to give a shout out to Zildemir, who gave a 5-star review and wrote, "Horror Weekly is what happens when Voice uses the opinions of more than 500,000 horror fans to delve into weekly topics on horror. The podcast is perfect to build your watch list, hear what others have to say, and maybe even change your opinion on Maximum Overdrive. Come for the voting and community and stay for the smart observations of the host." Thank you so much. Definitely come for the community. But I love that. I don't know which way your opinion was changed on Maximum Overdrive. I've seen it discussed both ways on our pages. So hopefully it was changed to the better, because I think that movie is fun as fuck. But keep the reviews and ratings coming. And thank you for your patience with the lateness of this episode. I will endeavor to not have that happen again. And speaking of, that means next Wednesday, new episode. Until then, have a great horror week.